It's a privilege to be able to chair this meeting here tonight. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love recovery and everything that it represents. And one of my prayers every morning since I've been in this program is to do the things that are necessary in order to encourage the enthusiasm required to maintain a level that I have managed to develop to stay in this program and do whatever's necessary. That enthusiasm is something that I admire and look for in other people. Now, I met this gentleman just yesterday, as a matter of fact, and have gotten to know him a little. It's a privilege to be able to chair this meeting here tonight. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love recovery and everything that it represents. And one of my prayers every morning since I've been in this program is to do the things that are necessary in order to encourage the enthusiasm required to maintain a level that I have managed to develop to stay in this program and do whatever's necessary. That enthusiasm is something that I admire and look for in other people. Now, I met this gentleman just yesterday, as a matter of fact, and have gotten to know him a little bit better today, and he exemplifies that enthusiasm to the nth degree of what I look for and the people involved in this program. So it's with great pleasure that I'd like to introduce to you and give us a big warm welcome to James M. from Slidell, L.A. Is that it?
That's it. You got it.
Spent some time this afternoon coaching him on how to say the name, Slidell. New Orleans, our largest suburb. It was blowing away, so I got out, came up here to be with you folks. Left a couple of members of my home group at the house. They reported to me, it's all right down there. It's all right, just got a little wet. My name is James Morrell. I'm an alcoholic. And it's only by the grace of a loving God and the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that working in my life and a lot of people just like you, I had my last drink July 11th of 1981. I'm very grateful for this period of sobriety, this new chance at life that I've been granted. God, y'all look beautiful out there tonight. Wow, look at you. Hi down there in the smoking room, too. Have a puff or two for me. I'll need one before this talk's over. Okay? Oh, thank you, Larry. Thank you, Larry. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you and Letha. And I want to thank you for your hospitality. There's been a great deal of hospitality here. I want to thank other members of the committee, Jay and Ray and Betty and all you folks for warm welcome that you have given me. I'm going to take my watch off here and take a close look at it. Jay's been threatening me all day. Jay says, James, you know, you'll never be alone again in Alcoholics Anonymous unless, of course, you talk over an hour. So just to make Jay feel better, I'm going to put this watch out here. I don't intend to look at it, but I'll put it out here. And he didn't get to charge me for the 15 minutes he spent up here making announcements either. You know, that's his time. That's his time. First of all, let me say that I'm a substitute here tonight. I'm a substitute speaker. Charlie Bartell, and I use his last name for two reasons. First of all, I have his permission. And secondly, I'm his sponsor. Charlie was scheduled to talk tonight. Charlie is the best AA that I know. Charlie is currently serving Alcoholics Anonymous as the U.S. trustee at large for the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous for the Board of Trustees. And whenever AA calls, Charlie has always been there. And his presence was required at the up in New Brunswick, Canada for a regional forum because somebody else couldn't make it. So he's up there doing the work of Alcoholics Anonymous this weekend, and he sends his love to y'all, and wishes that he could be here with you, and God willing, he will be here at this fellowship another time. But he's a good man, and although he calls me sponsor, I really believe that I've gotten a lot more out of him than he's ever gotten out of me. Before I get talking, you know, there is a spirit in this room tonight, as there is always a spirit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is a spirit that we bring here. We bring here. I was here earlier today, and this was just an empty room, you know, and we've come here and we brought this spirit. But there's also the spirit of those who've gone before us, who though not physically present, although not present in body, are present in our hearts and certainly present in this meeting. And we've lost some great ones over this past year. I was visiting with Tim, who's going to be our Friday night speaker from Cleveland, about Mace Hill, my good friend too from Pittsburgh, who went on to the big meeting last February. And of course, the spirit of Charlie Lowry is here tonight. And I wish to recall that spirit. Because if I've come to believe something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think this was James. This was James. James was a suit, and James was what he showed off to you, and he was what he had. And you've taught me that this is just where James lives, that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is this fundamental little piece of God, this fundamental piece of the Spirit. And that spirit is eternal and it's what we bring to this meeting. And I feel that the spirit of Charlie is at this meeting tonight. He went on to the big meeting this year. His lovely wife Ann is here tonight. I got to know Charlie a couple of times as I came to the gratitude retreat for the past two Januaries. And I got to know him a lot better because the last time I was there, Jay gave me a tape of Charlie's. And as I was leaving the gratitude retreat last January, I listened to Charlie's tape, and Charlie rode with me between here in Columbia, and I got to know him even more intimately. And we have the tape because of guys like Buck in Virginia, who come to these deals and who tape these conferences, and who've been doing it for many years. Buck's getting ready to retire after many, many, many years of wonderful service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's give Buck and Virginia a hand. Thank them for their wonderful service to us. Thank you. Thank you. I've been in Myrtle. You know, my last name is Morrell, but it's really not Morrell. It's really Merle. Really, you know, like Merle's Inlet, where Larry's from, right down there. My father, I guess he had one too many cocktails, moved us to Louisiana when I was about 10 years old, and all those French people down there started pronouncing it Morel instead of Merle. And it just kind of stuck, and it's been that ever since. So I have ancestors that came from just right down the beach down here, you know. And on my mother's side of the family, there was a guy named Albert Sidney Watson who left Charleston in the midst of the Civil War and wound up in the Texas Cavalry and wound up in Texas, and he was my mother's grandfather. And so I have a connection with South Carolina. I visited Myrtle Beach for the first time in 1968. I'd just gotten out of law school. Oh, that's another piece of bad news I didn't tell you. You know, you thought you were getting an AA trustee to talk, and you got a lawyer instead. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you any lawyer jokes. My sponsor says there are no lawyer jokes. They're all true stories. Oh, well. Like I say, I didn't really expect to, you know, I expect to come to this deal. I didn't expect to come up here and talk. Reminds me of the story. It seems like God and St. Peter got busy one day and kind of neglected the affairs of the world. And they were probably talking about golf or something. And this young couple was on the way to get married. And a train came through and just killed them dead, you know. And God looked down and said, oh, my God, St. Peter's been a terrible mistake. Go find that young couple and do whatever they want done, just take care of them. St. Peter went and got them, brought them into the pearly gates, said, look, bad mistake, but we're going to take care of you up here. God told me anything you want, we're going to do it for you. Couple said, well, we were on our way to get married. We'd like to get married. St. Peter said, get married? You don't get married in heaven. They said, well, that's what we want. We want to get married. God said, well, I better go. St. Peter said, I better go talk with a higher power and find out about this. So he goes, talks to God. God says, oh, Pete, you know, we got a problem here. You know, there's a little technical. Go stall them. Just go stall them. Tell them we'll do the best we can. So St. Peter goes and says, look, you can get married, but it's going to take a while. We've got a little few technical difficulties. So the couple says, well, all right. 200 or 300 years go by, which you know how time passes in heaven. And St. Peter goes to them, and they say, can we get married? And they say, no, not yet, not yet. Finally, another couple hundred years go by, and God calls Pete in and says, okay, Pete, those cows can get married now, but go tell them the good news and the bad news. So Pete goes to him and says, okay, you can get married now. He says, but there's good news and there's bad news. And he said, well, what's the good, what's good? Well, the good news is you get married. What's the bad news? He says, well, you can never, ever, ever get a divorce. I said, well, we weren't planning to get a divorce, but we're real curious. Why not? He said, well, it took us 400 years to get a preacher, and we're not expecting any lawyers. I don't know what that had to do with anything or not, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. First time I visited Myrtle Beach, I'd just gotten out of law school in 1968, and the drive for power and prestige was on with James, and my first job was not a legal job. I got a job with American Broadcasting Company with their TV news political unit for the 1968 presidential election. They stationed me here in South Carolina to set up a vote return network, and I brought my new wife, who was pregnant, and my daughter, little Amanda Murray, was born in Columbia, South Carolina in September of 1968. And in about October that year, we visited Myrtle Beach up here, and I can remember bringing that beautiful young baby and dipping her in the Atlantic Ocean out there, just dipping her and said, okay, little Murray, I want you to know that you've been in the Atlantic Ocean. And I tell you that story just to let you know that there was a great deal of hope at that time. But you see, I'm an alcoholic, and the symptoms of alcoholism were already starting to appear. There were two things that I learned in South Carolina. I'd existed on rather sharp rations in college and law school. You know, my parents had gotten divorced. My father wouldn't support me. And, I'd whine on about what a terrible father he was as much as I could. And this was the first time I had any money, and I discovered two things over here. First of all, the joys of expense account drinking. You know, I charged everything to ABC, and my God, I had a great time doing that. The second thing I discovered in South Carolina was for the first time in my life, I started paying attention to when the sun set. Y'all used to have a law here that the liquor stores were only open from sunrise to sunset. And that became a matter of great interest to me, you know. It really did. And then I went on to New Orleans, and I was trying to get a job down there, and I was having trouble getting a job because I had a weird law school record. You know, already, like I say, the symptoms of alcoholism were appearing in my life. And when time to graduate came along, Dean Hebert called me in and said, you know, you have one of the weirdest records of anybody that's ever graduated from LSU Law School. It's all A's and F's. He said, I don't understand that. I said, well, Dean beats me. But the truth of the matter was, if I had the combination of bourbon and dextrodrine just right, I aced that test. Too much dextrodrine, you wrote the whole time on question one. Too much bourbon, you passed out, you know. I thought I was a chemist. We talk about balance in AA. I was trying to get balance in my life about that time. And I'm trying to get a job down in New Orleans, and none of the law firms want to talk to me, you know. I mean, finally, one guy said, well, I tell you what I'll do. I'm not going to give you a formal interview, but I'll meet you for a few drinks. Don't meet an alcoholic for a few drinks. We go into the Court of Two Sisters, and he orders a Dewar's White Label and soda. Well, I'm a bourbon whiskey man. But if you're drinking Dewar's White Label and soda, that's my favorite drink. I'm drinking Dewar's White Label and soda. And I sat there and drank Dewar's White Label and soda with John until I had a job with that firm. He never looked at my resume. By midnight, he didn't care. See, alcohol was still working in my life. It still allowed me to do things that I didn't think I was capable of doing and go places that I didn't think I was worthy of going and accomplish things that I thought were beyond me. It was still working in my life, much as it had when I was a 14-year-old boy there in that little Catholic French town of New Iberia, Louisiana, where we had moved to. And I felt like an oddball in that town, you know. By the time I arrived there in the eighth grade, I'd attended something like 14 or 15 different schools all over Texas. And I always felt like the odd man out, you know. It seemed like no sooner than I started to get to know people that we moved, and we moved. My father was a traveling salesman, and around that age, he had settled down in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and he thought he had died and gone to heaven. He found where the party was in this United States of America. It was in the French Quarter. Now, he didn't want to cramp his style by having us there. He put us 150 miles away. We wind up there, and it seems as though at a very early age, I don't know, in the sixth or seventh or eighth move that we'd probably made, I remember I couldn't have been more than about 9 or 10, on a little schoolyard in a place called Grand Saline, Texas. And my grandparents lived there, and I was back at that school again. I think I'd have been there briefly the year before, and I'm feeling lost and alone, and Granny's been taking me to that Church of Christ, and my parents were Episcopal, and we go to church all the time, and I'd heard, you know, if you pray to God for something, he's going to answer your prayers. And I'd prayed to God that my parents would stop fussing and fighting and stop talking about divorce, and I prayed that we'd stop moving, and here we had moved again. And I remember standing down in that schoolyard and thinking, God doesn't answer prayers. God doesn't answer prayers. At least he doesn't answer my prayers. I mean, when I looked at my granny there in that church, I didn't doubt then at the age of 10, and I didn't doubt 20-some-odd years later when she finally died, that God answered her prayers. But I thought there was something wrong with me. There was something missing in me, because God didn't answer my prayers. God didn't answer my prayers. And I got another attitude at that point. And the attitude was simply this: if you're going to make it in this world, you're going to make it on your own. And I looked around at those other kids, and they fit, and they belonged, and they seemed to be so assured that they'd lived there all their life. And I didn't feel as good as they were. So I thought, if I can't be as good as you are, I'm going to show you I'm better than you are. And the one thing God had given me was a quick brain, and I'm the kid that can make the straight A's in school. So fast forward to 14, I'm at, talk about feeling an oddball, I'm the only Protestant in a Catholic school. You know, I really didn't fit. And I developed an obsession with food, and I was a little short, fat kid, and I was about 5 inches shorter than I am right now and weighed about 20 pounds more. And you know how loving kids are. They call me Tanky and Rubber Butt. You know, and if your nickname is Rubber Butt, and you're starting to, at 14, you start to notice girls. You know, you start to get those feelings. You know, and you notice those girls are changing, and you're not real sure what all the changes are. And of course, I was growing up in the 50s. You know, we got our sex education out of National Geographic. You know, this is long before cable TV and Playboy and everything. You know. We had sex ed in school. It was called recess, you know. You know, you listen to the wise 15-year-olds who seem to know it all, you know. And I'm noticing those girls, and of course they're not noticing me. And a friend of mine, and about the only friend I had, really. About the only friend I had. I was completely alone in that class. He said, let's go to a dance at the girls' school. It's a sock hop. I said, I don't want to go, you know. I was scared to go, is what it was. I knew I couldn't talk to any of those girls, much less ask them to dance. I didn't know how to dance. He says, oh, come on and go. And so I went on with him, and we went there, and it was a room not smaller than this, really. And the disc jockeys from the local radio station is playing Elvis Presley and Blue Suede Shoes and the Everly Brothers and that sort of thing. And I'm hanging around by the door, and the girls are way over there, and I'm way over here, and there's no way to get from here to there, and everybody else is having a great time, and I'm miserable. And Cyrus comes up to me and says, look, I got a fifth of Dad's old charter out in the car. You want a swig of it? And he could have said, I got a fifth of Drano out in that car. Would you? I'd have done anything to get out of that place. I said, yeah. Now, at that point, I've had drinks. You know, New Iberia's a drinking town. There was always wine on the table with Sunday dinner. There was beer. I had little sips of them. But see, it isn't quite enough to have an alcoholic personality. I believe that you've got to drink enough alcohol to do some good. Do some good. And that night when we went out to that deal, he pulled that fifth of old charter out, and he took that cork out of there, and it went ploop. Always loved that sound, you know, that ploop when that cork came out. And he took a pull out of it, and he went like that. And he handed it to me, and I thought, well, I'll do what he's doing. So I took a long pull out of it. Ooh, it went down in, and it burned. It tried to come back up, but I couldn't let him see me not hold it down. So I just held it down and said, that was good. Oh, yeah. I handed it back to him. He took a pull, and I took another pull, and all of a sudden, something happened. On that second pull of whiskey, I'd always felt like I was a jumble of mismatched, parts that didn't fit. It was probably put together on Monday on an assembly line when all the workers were hung over and they'd left some stuff out, and everything was jangling and whatever. And with that second long pull of old Charter, it felt like all the parts fit into place just like thud. I felt solid. I said, give me another drink of that. I didn't have another drink of that, and the pimples fell off my face. I want to tell you, Rubber Butt walked down into that parking lot, but Tab Hunter walked back in. And I was looking for Debbie Reynolds. I observed a phenomenon that night that many of you who are alcoholic probably observed it from time to time. You get a few drinks of me and you ladies sure do get looking good. Oh, yeah, you get to looking good. Of course, I've heard from a lot of women alcoholics that a few drinks improve the way that I looked, too. So I guess it works both ways. But I went in there and asked a girl to dance. I just walked right up to Nancy, and I said, I had a crush on Nancy for a long time. I said, Nancy, dance with me. And she did. I was just amazed. Hell, old Charter taught me more about dancing than Fred Astaire could have ever hoped to have done. I walked over to the guys over there, the football heroes and everything, you know, and they seemed to be interested in me. And pretty soon I was holding court with them. And I went back out to the parking lot and kept going back out, kept going back out, kept going back out. Got to feeling so good, couldn't feel it all. I may have gotten too drunk that night. I may be parched that night. I don't remember. Cyrus and I staggered back to my house, which was, it wasn't unusual for him to sleep over at my place or me at his. We only lived a couple of blocks away, and we staggered in, and he got sick, and I got sick, and, oh, we're puking all over the room. And my mama comes in, and she says, oh, what's the matter? Well, we gave her that alcoholic answer. Oh, mama, we got the flu. Thank God for mamas. Mamas will believe you at any time. My mama, she loved me, and she'd just believe anything I had to say. And it would have worked. Except doctors in those days made house calls. She calls up Dr. Gajan and says, come quick. Cyrus and James are dying, and he only lived a couple blocks away, a little small town, you know. And he rushes on over there, and we're going, whoop, 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 you know. And he walks in there, and he says, Wendy, these boys aren't sick, they're drunk. Busted my first time out. Woke up the next day feeling terrible, head ringing, mouth dry, scared to death of what I did or didn't do. And some guys stopped by and said, oh, you had a good time last night. I said, oh, I did? Oh, all right. Okay. That's not a trivial thing. You know, it turned my life around. See, it didn't what alcohol did to me. It's what it did for me and what it did for me from an early age. I chased that feeling. I was never able to completely duplicate that total change of my relationship to the universe, this complete alteration of my attitude for the rest of my drinking career, but I pursued that feeling, and I want to tell you that I pursued it virtually into the gates of insanity and death. And I'm not one of these people that immediately lost total control. You know, from a shy, reclusive bookworm, I could start to relate to people. Alcohol did a lot for me. I graduated valedictorian of my class, got elected president one year, went off to LSU on a National Merit Scholarship, but by the age of 19, alcohol was already interfering in my life, as I told you. I became a daily drinker and a periodic drunk, and sometimes those drunks would last long, and sometimes they coincided with finals, and I wouldn't show up for my final exams. Then I'd pull myself back together. It's what Dr. Silkworth calls, in the doctor's opinion, the cycle of spree and remorse. I'd throw a spree, and then I'd be so sad, and I'd pull myself back together. I'd be so remorseful, and I would grit my teeth and pull all my willpower together. After all, hadn't the good Christian brothers there at Catholic High taught me the poem of Invictus, you know, I'm the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul. You know, if it's going to get done, James has got to do it. You see how isolated and alone I'm becoming already as an alcoholic. You know, everything depends on me. I could pull myself back together. And gradually, sometime around the age of 30, and I'd had an early good legal career. God had given me a gift to do that. I was enjoying what I was doing. I made partner with the biggest law firm in Louisiana. And alcohol, if it does that much for you, starts to do things to you. I found that I started to need a drink in the morning just to sign my name because my hands were shaking so badly. I'd take the clients out for lunch and maybe not come back in the afternoon. And then I would start not showing up at all. And gradually, all the things in my life that appeared important to me seemed to be leaving. All of a sudden, this beautiful young wife who had... I was always trying to fix this great empty feeling that I had on the inside with things that I found on the outside. You know, if I had the right wife, and I had this beautiful young daughter, well, daughter isn't enough. Maybe we had a son. Okay, we had a son. Just being hired by this firm isn't enough. If I made partner, okay, made partner. If I got rid of this wife, if I got the sailboat, I tried it all. You know, I got nailed by a fortune cookie. I got nailed. Everybody else goes to these Chinese restaurants and gets these fortune cookies saying, you're handsome or wonderful things are going to happen to you. About 3 years ago, I swear to God, my sponsor stuck this fortune in that cookie. I was at Yee's Chinese Buffet in Slidell, Louisiana, and I pull out a fortune, and it says, "You have tried wealth, and you have tried poverty, and they have both failed you." Thanks a whole lot, you know. I got that stuck up on my computer to this day. But that kind of tells my story. I tried it all. I was trying to fix an inside problem. I was trying to fix my spiritual vacuum, a need for God, although I didn't recognize it as that. I'd left God long behind, you know. I'd left any form of religion behind. I was going to exist strictly on my own, and all of that went. Slowly all it went. The day came kind of when, I had to drink to go to trial. And then the day came when the drink wouldn't even take the fear away and I could no longer try a lawsuit. And that's what I did. I tried lawsuits. And I was too scared to go into court. And I went and resigned my law partnership. And then I went into practice on my own. And then I, spree and remorse, just like Dr. Silkworth says, pull it together for a while. But see, alcoholism is a progressive illness. It gets worse and never gets better. And before it kills you, it takes away from you every thing that's valuable in life, because it certainly did so for James. If you fast forward to around 1980, the wife was gone, the kids were gone. I hadn't seen my children in 2 years, or even talked to them. I'm living alone in my house. All my friends are gone. For many years in my drinking career, I was a social chairman. I got elected social chairman of my college fraternity, my law school fraternity. I was the guy that planned the parties at the firm. And I'd become the drunk down at the end of the bar, staring into the mirror, drinking alone, wondering where everybody is gone. Where have they all gone? Found myself drinking alone in my kitchen. And the book talks about that loneliness that few know. I started to make the rounds of psychiatrists and hospitals, and I tried all the other things, the megavitamin therapy, the exercise, drinking just beer, drinking white wine. God, that one should have worked, too. That really should have worked. You know, I saw this interview on television. Barbara Walters was interviewing Robert Redford, you know. And Robert Redford's on TV, and he's twirling this glass. And it's one of these long-stem wine glasses. I mean, that sucker was about a foot high, you know. And it's got a white liquid in it. And she says, "I notice that you're drinking what appears to be white wine." He says, "Oh, yes, I was having a problem with booze. And so I found that if I only drink natural California white wine, that I don't have a problem." And I thought, that's it. Natural California wines. Natural California wine. I mean, it's Barbara Wawa and Robert Brent. Oh, by the way, you know what you get if you cross Barbara Walters and a pit bull? You get Mad Dog 2020. Oh, well, that didn't have anything to do with anything. Anyway, I see him there, and I think, God, I could cure my drinking problem. I could cure it. And so I go out, and I get my car, and I zoom on over to Schwagman Brothers Giant Supermarkets, which has this huge wine department. And I think, if I'm going to cure this drinking problem, I've got to really be committed to it. So I bought 6 cases of natural California white wine. And I zoom on down to Adler's Jewelry Store, and I try to find a crystal wine glass like... I really preferred it out of the bottle, but anyway, you know. Have you noticed they no longer sell Ripple? We ought to have a moment of silence for Ripple. Anyway, that was really more my style. But anyway, if he's going to drink it out of this crystal glass, I go down and I pay about $35 for a glass, you know. And I go home and I put on my blazer, because he had on a blazer. And I said, I find a corkscrew somewhere. You know, I prefer the screw caps. Pull that sucker out of there, and I'm going to drink white wine. And just like it says in chapter 3, there was often brief recovery followed by a still worse relapse. And for a little while, everybody was saying, "James, you're doing so well. You look better." And I'd carry that steal with me everywhere, and I'd twirl that wine glass, and I'd say, natural California wines. And they'd say, you're really doing great, natural California wines. But if you're a real alcoholic, that ain't going to get it one day. And one day I was at a deal, and I'd even been welcomed back into a little political organization, and we had a little deal for a congressman that I had helped in a couple of campaigns. And I remember there's a fifth of Gilby's gin on the table right after you'd left. And I remember reaching over it and thinking, this just isn't getting it. And I started swigging out of the Gilbert's gin. But within a week, all the crystal was smashed. The bottles were smashed. Everything was, I was smashed. You know, it all worked, but it never worked for very long. It never worked for very long. That should be sufficient to tell you that I'm an alcoholic. I started appearing. Last time I was in a nut house, that was one of the great points of despair. Because I had been convinced for years that I was crazy. You see, I tried not drinking. When I didn't drink, I felt nuttier than when I drank. And it seemed that alcohol was the only thing that could relieve the shakes in my hands. It was the only thing that could relieve this terrible noise in my head. And so not drinking didn't seem the solution, but yet I'm having this terrible drinking problem at the same time. Never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the kind of guy that could watch Days of Wine and Roses and get a resentment against Jack Lemmon because he wouldn't go drink with Lee Remick. I didn't have any idea the thing was about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Oh, God, good-looking gal like Lee Remick wants you to drink with you. Drink with her, for crying out loud. You know, I missed the whole point. The only connection I had to AA was, or I recall it being mentioned, I was trying to date a really neat little gal back in 1965 named Jean. And she kind of blew me off. And the last thing she sent me was a card, and I've still got it today. And on the outside of the card, it says, you're the kind of guy I would like to take home to mother. And you open it up on the inside, and it says, she's the chairman of our AA group. I think somebody knew a long time before I did. I really think so. But I'm in the nut house. I'm in the nut house. And it's not a treatment center. It's a mental ward. And I thought a long time that I was crazy. And I was actually, I'd been on a drunk for about a month. And I'd showed up at my psychiatrist's office holding a fifth of gin. I don't know why this gin keeps playing this problem. I'm not a gin drinker. I'm a bourbon drinker. But somehow I had a bottle of gin. And I said, doctor, you've got to put me somewhere where I can't get a drink. I can't stop drinking. First time I ever admitted that to any human being. I'd never been honest with him about my drinking. And he didn't put me in a treatment center. He didn't tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He stuck me in the mental ward. Diagnosed me as a depressive. I thought he was depressing. After I'd been in there about a week or two, and I got sober, I looked around at those people, and I thought, my God, I am really in trouble. I am seriously in trouble. I'm crazy, but I'm not crazy like these people are crazy. I mean, there were some nice people. You know, I'd been in there 2 weeks, and now I'm sober. You put an alcoholic in a nut house, we have the place organized within 2 weeks. You know, we're running the deal. We're telling the nurses what to do, the psychiatrist what to do, and everything. And, oh, they're so appreciative of our suggestions, you know. But the rest of the nuts were going right along with it because, you know, I mean, they weren't sure where they were or who they were, you know. They were things like, do you know who I am? No, but if you ask the nurse, she'll tell you, you know. My book uses the phrase that we have been strangely insane. Strangely insane. Because, see, I knew I was insane, but I'm not crazy like the crazy people are crazy. I don't fit out there. I don't fit in here. Where the hell do I fit? Afterwards, I'm going to group therapy. I get out. I'm going to group therapy. I'm going for a week or two. Group therapy is dreadful. And finally, one day, I just spoke up. I hadn't even talked in group therapy. I finally spoke up one day, and I said, I'm ready to go get drunk. I said, I've been afraid to leave my house for a couple of weeks now. Because everybody I know drinks. I don't see, New Orleans is a drinking society. That's why I went to New Orleans. I knew that's where the party was. The bars are open 24 hours a day. And I didn't know anybody that didn't drink. And a lady came up to me after that group therapy session. God bless her to this day. And she never did make it in this program. But she says, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? You'll meet some people that don't drink. So I came to you not to get sober. I came to you to simply meet some people that didn't drink. And I didn't want to come here. I thought she was talking about something down around the Baptist Mission in the Wino District. She said, no, there's one out, see my ego, you know, there's one out near Tulane University, and there's some doctors and lawyers and professors and people that went there. You know, you had to appeal to my ego to even get me there. And I went to that meeting. And I was absolutely astounded. I thought it was going to be another group therapy session. If any of you have ever been in group therapy, you know, nobody ever laughs in group therapy. Once in a while, there's a nervous giggle or a little forced hilarity. But I walk in this meeting, and you people are laughing about things that I've been advising my clients to keep secret for years. My mama told me, you don't talk about that. And y'all are laughing about it. Now, I've done all these things, but I'm horrified. I mean, you know, I think, where am I, you know? But your laughter was infectious to me from that first day in March 23rd of 1980 until I got sober a year and a half later until this very day. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I fell in love with the people, and I fell in love with the laughter. I didn't know then that the laughter was the sound of the language of the heart. I didn't know that then, but I just knew that I was powerfully attracted because I'd become so sad and I hadn't laughed in a long time. And I'd love to tell you that March 23rd, 1980 was my sobriety day. Because from that day to this, I've virtually not missed a day of meeting Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. The next year and a half, I was in your meetings 1, 2, 3, and 4 times a day. And I say your meetings. They weren't my meetings yet because all I was doing was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wouldn't work for me. I mean, I'm an Episcopalian, a fallen away Episcopalian, who went to Roman Catholic schools, who had one Church of Christ grandmother and one Southern Baptist grandmother. And I heard Brother Barber at that Church of Christ looking down over a pulpit just like this and saying, if you think it, you might as well have done it. I thought, oh, my God, he knows what I'm thinking. Oh, he knows what I'm thinking. I'm sitting here in church thinking it. Oh. I look around those other people. They're not thinking it. God. Then I go over to the Catholic school I was going to, and Monsignor Boudreau would be saying the same thing. If you're thinking it, you might as well do it. And there wasn't a dime difference between the two, except Monsignor Boudreau wore a dress, you know. It just, about the only difference I could find. I figured, hell, I'm damned to this church. I'm damned to this church. You know, I'm just, it won't work for me. Works for them, won't work for me. And I missed the whole idea of God as you understand it. I miss the whole idea of becoming involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I miss the whole idea of taking any actions other than coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. The result was I got drunk about 40 times. Sometimes I had to have a drink to go to an AA meeting. Sometimes I had to have a drink to ponder on what I'd heard at the AA meeting. And when you're down at the Boucherie Bar in the French Quarter and you're ordering doubles and you're trying to read the 12 and 12 to Gus the bartender. Here, Gus, let me tell you all about step 11. He's looking at you like you're from another planet, you know, which you are. You see, same deal. I didn't fit out there. Didn't fit in here. Let me tell you about my last drunk. You know, because my time came. And thank God I'd been to all those AA meetings. Maybe I needed to hear that in order to surrender. My last drunk started in Shreveport, Louisiana. I'd gone up there to help a client sell a little business, just a little beauty shop, you know. By this point, all the money was gone, all the big money that I'd made. The year before I came to AA, I made $300,000, spent $350,000. There's never enough money for a drinking drunk. You know, finished the year more in debt than I started it. A year or two later, I ain't making anything, and I'm go up there for sale of a beauty shop, and we go to some restaurant afterwards, bar and restaurant, look a lot like a Bennigan's or a Friday's or something, and I'd shot my mouth off to my clients. You know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm living a spiritual way of life, and I'm allergic to alcohol, and it's poison to me, and I'm never, ever going to drink again as long as I live. You know, just arrogant nonsense. But it paints you into a corner, because when your client orders a drink, you can't very well order a drink. But I'd have probably made it, except that Bobby ordered a Colorado Bulldog. And I thought to myself, James, you have never heard of a Colorado Bulldog. You have never tasted a Colorado Bulldog. You have never even smelled a Colorado Bulldog. Where I thought, wouldn't it be a shame if you never tasted a Colorado Bulldog, since you're never going to have a drink again as long as you live? And I reached over and grabbed Bobby's Colorado Bulldog, and I chug-a-lugged it. She says, I thought you couldn't drink. Says, can now. Whew, I was thirsty. Oh, God, it was sicky sweet. Oh, it tasted sort of like Dr. Pepper and cough syrup. God, I'm going to die of terminal sweetness. And the only thing I could think of to cut that cloying sweetness was bourbon whiskey. Give me a double. That was the last funny thing that happened to me on that drunk, because I somehow or other managed to make it back to New Orleans. I don't really remember the trip. And for the next week, I was on the kind of drunk that I'd been on many times in the past, a kind of drunk that with an additional element of hopelessness. I would drink for 2 or 3 hours, and I would pass out for 2 or 3 hours. And I would drink for 2 or 3 hours, and I would pass out for 2 or 3 hours. I could no longer drive my automobile. A United cab was delivering cheap drugstore vodka to me. I drank up everything else in the house. I drank the vanilla extract. I drank the NyQuil. I drank the Paco Rabanne aftershave. And that's not social drinking, you know. I mean, you don't exactly go to the bartender at the Royal Orleans Hotel at the piano bar and say, I'll have a double Listerine on the rocks with a twist. It'll do the job, though. It will. And I'm ordering drugstore vodka, and when I see 7 o'clock on the clock, I don't know whether it's 7 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock at night. But see, this, I'd been on drunks like this before, but this was even more hopeless because alcohol had truly stopped working for me. See, if I drank enough, I could seek that oblivion. The book talks about some of us who just try to go off into seeking that oblivion. And I couldn't get the oblivion. No matter how drunk I got, my head remained clear. And all the guilt and the shame and the failures and, you know, I hadn't seen my kids for 2 years. The law practice is gone. The friends are gone. All the dirty, rotten things that I'd done and all the wasted opportunities. And it was just all there. But you're even a failure as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't even stay sober doing this. Time and time again, members of AA have come here and picked you up and sobered you up and carried you around for a day or so to get you sober, and you've let them down because you've drank again and again, and you've lied to them. You've picked up chips you haven't earned. You know, they said, anybody want a 30-day chip? Oh, yeah, I'll take a 30-day chip. Might have been drunk the night before, you know, and I felt absolutely humiliated. Absolutely humiliated. And I felt so hopeless, and I couldn't kill myself. I had a Walter PPK and a sawed-off shotgun, and I was cursing myself as a coward because I couldn't pull the trigger. I couldn't pull it. I woke up on the morning of July the 11th, 1981, needing a drink as badly as I have ever needed a drink in my life. My head was pounding. My mouth was dry. When I'm on that kind of drunk, I keep my vodka in the freezer because that first drink will stay down and you don't go into the dry heaves, you know. And if I go into the dry heaves, the blood starts coming up. And for some reason, I didn't go immediately to that freezer. For some reason, I stopped at the kitchen table, and I sat down in that chair and I looked at that refrigerator, and it was though the faces of Alcoholics Anonymous came to me. Faces of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time I realized that you had not been conning me, that you had something. And it was though I could see the words of the second step. See, I'd always read the second step as, I believe in God. Alright, so what? So you believe in God. So what? God's way out there. I'm not an atheist. I believe there's a God way out there, but he hadn't done anything for me since I was 10 years old. That's my attitude. And exact words came to me. So they were written on the refrigerator. It came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's like I saw the exact words. And I thought, as I saw in my mind's eye your faces, you all believe in something. Perhaps somebody had said at one of those meetings, I know I heard it later, I'm not sure what I heard before that, but perhaps I'd heard that first we come, and then we come to, and then we come to believe. And I thought, maybe I can come to believe whatever it is that you all believe in. You know, we have a line in our book on page 51. And I had read this book at this time. I'd briefly scanned it, thought it was quaint, written in 1939. Surely there's something more important than that that's been published since then. And dismissed it. The arrogance. And there's a line in here on 51 that says, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. I had read those words, but that's what the people who had constantly continued to love me time after time as I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous drunk had presented to me a powerful reason. And I thought maybe I could come to believe whatever the hell it is they believe in. And I said a prayer at that point. I don't know where this prayer came from, but I submit to you, if you're sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, you've said something like this. You said something along this line. But this is what James said. And I simply said, God, if there is a God, I don't want to drink that vodka. Please help me. Please help me. It was as though the fight went out. I was so tired. I mean, I was not only hungover and terrible and still half drunk or whatever, you know. I was just so tired. And when I'm tired, I'm so tense. I was just balled up. And it was like all the fight went out of me. It was like all the fight went out of me. The guy, like Fred, the accountant, in chapter 3 of our book of experience, what he says, he has that curious feeling that the alcoholic problem been relieved. And it was just a sound like, it's over. I just had the feeling it's over as soon as I said that prayer. And I sat there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I don't know how long. And I thought, I don't know what's over, but it's over. It's just over. And after a little while, I went over and I did something I've never done before in my life. I got the vodka out of the freezer and I poured it down the sink. Oh, I poured out booze a lot of times, you know, especially when she was watching. You know, oh, yeah, baby, I'm never going to drink again as long as I live. Just watch that booze go down the drain. I'd have some stashed under the car seat or somewhere else, you know, but there was no more in the house. And I poured it down the deal. And I didn't go to the hospital and I didn't get all the liquid Valium and all those other things that doctors... He took a shot at me. I ran him off the road, you know. So I head on out there and put a Band-Aid over it. Anyway, a little green tape, you know. Went out there, and it's just a little church, you know, and a little church hall. And I think, odd place for a jet set. But I look around for the Porsches and the Corvettes and the BMWs, and they weren't there. You know, there were Chevrolets and pickup trucks and Fords, you know. And I'm thinking... it's an anonymous program, you know. These are their anonymous cars. They drive to meetings. The jet setters do, you know. So I went in there, and I'm looking around for all the jet setters, and they didn't look like jet setters to me. In fact, if you took the first 16 people on this row or this row, they look about what they look like, you know. And I thought, well, but it is anonymous, you know. I'll just hang around. I was really relieved to not know a single soul in the place. And I'm going over there, and I get about half a cup of coffee. You see, I'm still at the stage where it takes both hands to even hold a half a cup of coffee. And I'm standing there near the coffee urn when all of a sudden the whole building rattles. There's this roar like, and the building shakes and everything. Oh, whoa, what was that? What was that? What was that? Big old Eddie DeSadia looks down at me and says, well, that's the airplane going over. We're in the flight path of the airport. That's why we call it the jet set. Oh, no. I've been tricked. Newcomer, they'll trick you to get you into this program. They will. But I'll tell you, in a way, that was the most important meeting I've ever been into, because I came there, and I didn't know it at the time, but I came there surrendered to the idea that in and of myself, I could not do this thing and that I somehow needed help. And that's the essence of the first two steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I believe, if I've come to believe. And I was willing to listen. I mean, I heard things at that meeting I'd never heard before. At that point, I'd probably been to 400 AA meetings. I'd never heard the 12 promises. And this beautiful woman named Dee Dee Hoffman, who's now gone to the big meeting, is chairing the meeting. And I didn't know she had been chairman of the International Convention the previous year when it was held in New Orleans. I didn't know she was a pastor. All I knew was this elegant lady up there talking about freedom from fear. And fear was the absolute greatest secret of my life. I could not let you know that I was afraid. Not let you know that I was inadequate. She's talking about that, but she's saying if you take steps to this program, that this is what will happen. And her whole demeanor shouted at me that this had happened in her life. And I'd always been mystified by this idea of the first drink, and there was an old gold miner there from Nevada and California who's still sober to this day down in Florida. His name's Hoyt. And Hoyt always introduces himself this way. See, this first drink is absolute nonsense. It wasn't the first drink. If I could cut it over off, if I could just cut it off before that last fifth, I wouldn't have any trouble, you know. And Hoyt introduced himself this way. He said, my name's Hoyt, and I'm an alcoholic. If I don't take a drink tonight, I won't need one tomorrow morning. And it was like a light bulb went off my head. Boom. Yeah, James, that's the deal. That's the deal. When you take a drink tonight, by tomorrow morning, or even maybe by 15 minutes from now, at some point or other, James, you're going to need a drink. That's what they're talking about. That's what they're talking about. So some important things happened to me at that meeting. Nothing more important than I became willing to listen. And after the meeting, Eddie DeSadia, who's gone on to the big meeting now with about 24 years sobriety, was standing there, and I'm kind of standing around, looking around. He says, here, help me pick up the ashtrays and the coffee cups. And I looked around. See, I've been to 400 AA meetings, but I've never done any of this stuff before. You're here to serve me. I'm a taker, not a giver. I said, this meeting doesn't have a janitor? Well, Eddie's about a head taller than me, and he kind of gets over me and says, no, but you'll doodle one comes along. Okay. So I go and I start picking up the coffee cups and the ashtrays, and then he cons me into helping him stack the chairs, and then he tells me he expects me to be there a half an hour before the meeting the next night, and I go there, and I'm grumbling, and I'm doing this, and then he tells me to give some guy a ride back to the mission who's stinking, and all these things start happening, and after a couple of weeks, he says, you show up early and make the coffee. Here's the key to the place. Couldn't believe it. I'm about 3 weeks sober, and he gives me the key to the place. And I show up to make the coffee, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to ask anybody how to make coffee. I'm not going to read the instructions. I'm not going to do that. Al-Anon, so you understand that I'm an alcoholic now? You ever seen alcoholics act that way? Yeah. I'm not going to ask anybody. It's a big silver coffee pot. It's going to take a lot of coffee. I bring 2 pounds of New Orleans dark roast coffee and chicory. I pour it in there. I want them to have good coffee, you know? Nothing weak. Nothing weak. If you do that, roofing tar comes out. The topic of the meeting becomes the coffee. I thought, oh my God, they're going to kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm gone now. Oh, Lord. But you didn't. You loved me. You did send someone with me the next night to help me make coffee. You did do that, but you didn't kick me out. The only reason I'm telling you all that is because before it was always your meeting. But as I arrived early, helped set up, picked things up afterwards, made the coffee, went out with you after the meeting, it became my meeting. I, who was isolated and alone, as Bill talks about in the 12-12 in a self-constructed prison, started to feel like I fit and belonged someplace. Fit and belong someplace. See, the problem with the alcoholic is not an inability to love. God, I'd loved so much all my life. I had loved so many things. I had loved my children, but I hadn't seen them for 2 years. I had loved my first wife, and I couldn't stay with her. I had loved my law partners. My problem was that I never felt worthy to receive love in return. It's like in the song Desperado that the Eagles sing. You know, why don't you let somebody love you before it's too late? And I didn't know how to do that. I couldn't accept love. And y'all taught me first responsibility. First responsibility. And from the responsibility of simply showing up and doing these things, then I began to care about what I was doing. Then I began to care for you, and at some point or other, my first sponsor, who lectured me, because I came in one day, I'd put on a suit, and I hadn't taken it off for the meeting. See, I was still dressing down for the meeting and still using profanity at meetings. And he really had to get on me because I was trying to fit with the lowest common denominator. And one time I wore a suit to a meeting because I'd come there straight from some business. And he said, nice looking jacket. I said, oh, this old thing, you know, it's old. I've had three. He says, I'm not interested in your opinion. I was telling you it's a nice looking jacket. He says, you're depriving me of the opportunity to show my generosity in making a nice comment. He says, when somebody does something for you in AA, all you're allowed to do is say thank you. Then he's got me saying thank you to this God at night and please in the morning. Simple place to start. I had to start at the simple places because I'm a very complicated person. I'm a very complicated person. See, that ability to love and to allow you to love me was down in there all the time, but it was covered up by so much garbage. And when I was about 4 months sober, I realized that I was sober with a difference, that I was no longer fighting alcohol, that something had been removed from me. I didn't know what the obsession to drink alcohol was until it was gone. And it was simply that constant thought that I'd had for the year and a half I'd been in AA and for years before then. Can I drink? Can I not drink? Maybe if I just drank beer. Suppose that maybe I, you know, just that constant whirring in my mind. It was gone. It hadn't been there. It was there. And every night I was laying down there feeling rather foolish, saying simple. I mean, I'm a guy that knows the Catholic liturgy, knows the Episcopal liturgy, and I'm supposed to say, thank you, God. Thy will be done. Please, God. But these things worked. This was exactly what I needed. Exactly. And when I was 4 months sober, I heard a man, Dr. Gene, stand up here and tell his story. And he said he couldn't take a third step because he just didn't know what it was all about, and it was so confusing. And a priest who was in the same jitter joint he was in, who was also a drunk, said, well, maybe if we, it says in the book, maybe if we do it together, we can do it. And he said, they did it together. And I got to thinking about that, and at the meeting, the next night, after the meeting, went out to the Tiffin Inn Pancake House for the meeting after the meeting, where the real work of the meeting gets done. And we're sitting around talking, and Julie, she was an old-timer, had 4 years. I said, Julie, you know, maybe Dr. Jean was right. Maybe the only way I'll ever take a third step is to do it with another human being. She says, are you willing to do it right now? I said, Julie, this is a pancake house. You don't pray in pancake houses. She says, you may not get the opportunity again. Are you willing to do it right now? And I said, well, yeah. And with members of the Jet Set group, we held hands around the leftover food, and we said the wonderful prayer that's found on page 63 of our big book. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self. The bondage of self. That fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity it speaks of on the previous page. That I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. Why? So that I can be wonderful? No, so that victory over them may bear witness to some other alcoholic that I may help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And I say that prayer to you tonight because a man said it to me from the podium 21 years ago, and it changed my life. And it changed my life in this. I was expecting some clouding of the clouds and a booming voice saying, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. That didn't happen. God didn't send me a burning bush. Probably wouldn't have liked the color. You know, what he did send me was, for some reason, I, who had never read on in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, read on to the next page where it said, this decision, the third step decision, though a vital and crucial one, was of no permanent effect unless followed at once by an effort to face and be rid of the things that were blocking us, our bottles that were a symptom. And you see, I'd ask Gene and I'd ask Eddie at that little convention we'd gone to, what is this decision? He said, oh, it's just a decision to turn your will. If you can't turn it over to God, turn it over to Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a decision to go on the steps. And for some reason, I read on there, and I went out that next day to City Park, and I sat on an oak table on a pine table under an oak tree with a Spanish moss hanging. It was an overcast November day. And I got out a legal pad and I started writing. And I wrote down the secrets of my life because I'd heard him say that, I'd heard Eddie L. say that you're only as sick as your secrets. And I had a lot of secrets. I had things that I'd never told the priest or the preacher or the girlfriend or the bartender or the psychiatrist. Dirty little things that I carried with me from one time I was a boy. All the trivial stuff. You know, you brag about the big stuff. Oh, yeah, I ripped off the insurance company for $500,000. You know, you brag about stuff like that. But the little trivial stuff, the money you stole out of your mom's purse, you know, you don't want to put stuff like that down. That's humiliating. But I put it down there. And as I put it down there, I started to feel a freedom coming. I stopped. Bill calls it. Bill says what Ebbie Thatcher told him when he came there. He said, Bill, we got to quit this accursed business of living alone. And I think that I stopped the business of living alone as I started to write that first four step. I started to feel freedom. See, up to that point, my higher power had been the group. And right at sunset, the world was getting a little dark. The overcast was very low. Sometimes in New Orleans, perhaps you've experienced that around here, being near the sea, where you get this overcast that's only maybe 400 or 500 feet off the ground. And right at sunset, the clouds broke on the horizon, and the whole world just turned orange. Just, you know, it was like it was lighted up there. I'd seen that before, but I'd never noticed it. And it was almost as though God was winking at me. Because, you see, it's not that these things haven't happened before. It's that I was so wrapped up in myself, I've never noticed the world before. And I noticed it then. And I felt the warmth go through me. And the group wasn't there, but I was taking a step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt for the first time, just in a little small way, a conscious presence of God, a God that wished me well, Let me wrap this up with a couple of stories. My life has changed because of taking the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've taken them again and again. I eventually told my entire story to another human being. And that's when I felt like I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor put me on doing some things and not doing some things and asking God for God's help to do those. He said, well, why don't you stop stealing for first place, you know, that wonderful collection of hotel and motel silverware and towels you've got. Why don't we put an end to that, first of all? Well, Ed, I've got quite a collection. Well, we're going to stop doing that. Okay. Trivial stuff like that, but important. Important to me that I stopped doing it. And I made that list. And I went to people. And as I did that, I started to feel clean. Let me tell you about it in a minute or two and then wrap the thing up by telling you a little bit about where I am today. You know, I've mentioned that father of mine, the father that I had come to hate, the father that had divorced my mother, was never at home. I mean, he came home once a week or once a month or once a year. He didn't support me in college. You know, he never told me that he loved me. I just, you know, I could rattle on and on. One time, about 3 years before I came to the program, my psychiatrist told me to write him a letter and tell him all the things that he had done to me. And I'm ashamed to this day of that letter, which I still have a copy of, unfortunately. And I need, fortunately, really, because I need to look at it. And I poured out all the anger and all the junk. But my sponsor tells me, he says, and I'm telling my sponsor this, and he says, go to your father and tell him you love him. I said, why should I do that? He needs to come tell me that. He's been a rotten father. He says, we're not trying to save his rear end. We're trying to save yours. He may have been a rotten father, but you're a rotten son. He says, you go to him. He says, haven't you had enough hard knocks in your real life to realize he's had some hard knocks? So at almost a year sober, I went to my father and I said, I'm trying to live a new way of life and I haven't had a drink in some time now. And I just wanted to tell you that I'd like to have a new relationship with you and I'd like to set any wrongs right that I could and that I love you. And he put his arms around me and he kissed me on the cheek and he says, that's really hard for me to say. He says, I never heard my father say that. And all of a sudden my heart melted. He got sick after that, and I took care of him the last 5 years of his life. But the result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was that when he died, I wasn't filled with bitterness and guilt and blaming it on him and whatever else. I could feel honest grief. I could cry the tears of grief by him. And we were at peace. You know, those kids that I hadn't seen for 2 years, you know, my sponsor said, pay your child support. Well, she won't let me see the kids. I'll pay her when she lets me see the kids. No, you pay the child support first. All right, I paid it. Kids came for a visit. When I was 3 years sober, watch what you pray for. I said, God, please send a beautiful young woman into my life. My 15-year-old daughter showed up for a visit and left 8 years later. Oh, well. But I got to walk her, I got to be at her high school graduation. I got to be at her college graduation. Her mom didn't show up for either one of those. And I got to walk her down the aisle. And I walked her down the aisle, and by that point she had established some sort of rapport with her stepfather. I said, I want my stepfather to walk me down the aisle too. Now my first reaction was, can't do that. Then I thought, well, AA's altered attitudes. You give me a new way to look at things. Sponsor said, take a new way to look at it. I thought, yeah. You know, motives don't count in this deal. I thought, that poor so-and-so has had to put up with what's-her-name number one for all these years. He needs to be cut a little slack. I said, yeah, I can do that. We both walked her down the aisle. And so I was there for that. My son, whose mother raised him, we were estranged for about 5 or 6 years. I don't know why. But he called me New Year's Eve, this past New Year's Eve, after disappearing out of my life 4 or 5 years. And then he called me in March and told me that I was a grandfather for the first time, a beautiful little girl named Emily Madeline. And then he invited me to come visit him. And my sponsor said, I said to my sponsor, what should I do? He says, nothing. He said, just go visit him. So I did. You know, so nothing had happened. And sure enough, we took up right where we left off. We never had a fight. We just took up where we left off. He called me a few hours ago just to see how I was doing. And I talked to my daughter before. My practice has been restored to me. I'm a member of the Strange Camels group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Slidell, Louisiana, a wonderful group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm active in this program. I'm going to leave you with just a couple of thoughts. First of all, still to this day, I am coming to believe in a power greater than myself, and I'm coming to believe that that power will not only restore me to sanity, but give me an abundant and wonderful life. I believe that each and every day is a day that I come to believe. And so, and the only way I can come to believe is coming to you people. Because you see, every once in a while, God will touch me with a special feeling of a conscious contact with a thing, but not all the time. I can't always feel God working in my life, in the good times and in the bad. And I've had some bad times and I've had some good times. And had we the time, I could share them all with you. I've had wonderful times. But if I keep coming to you, I can observe the grace of God working in your lives. I see it all the time. I see it in the newcomer getting sober, and I see it in the old timer getting through family illness or death or tragedy. I see that. And I see it on a daily basis because I come to you and I observe the grace of God working in your life on a daily basis. And when I see that, I'm then able to feel that it's also working in mine. I'm just one of those people that, as it says, God could and would if he were sought. I'm just a seeker. I keep coming back to you. And in the process, God has granted to me all of the carpenter said, fear not, little flock, for it is the Father's good pleasure to grant you the secret desires of your heart. And every secret desire in my heart's ever been granted. See, I thought the secret desires were her or her or her or the boat or the law partnership or something, and it wasn't that at all. I got the secret desires, but the trick was it was secret from me. I didn't know what I wanted. It turned out that I wanted to be with you folks. That I wanted to just be a good human being. That I wanted to make things right with my family. That I wanted to feel and live clean and live happy and have a good time. And I've had one this weekend. Let me leave you with this meditation. For it is my favorite one. This was a meditation. And I've changed a couple of words in it to more apply to me. But this was a meditation found in the Bible of an anonymous Confederate soldier found dead on the battlefield at Shiloh. And it's important to me. You know, three of my grandfathers wore the gray, but the one from West Virginia wore the blue. Great-grandfathers. And it kind of expresses this program to me. It says, I ask God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to serve. I ask for health that I might do greater things. I was given the alcoholic illness that I might do better things. I ask for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I must learn wisdom. As for power, that I might have the praise of men, I was made powerless, that I might find the need of God. As for all things, that I might enjoy life, and I was given life, that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I hoped for. And I am among all men most richly blessed. Thank you for your lives. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.